Well, we are starting a new series this morning, Dare to be a Disciple, which of course is the theme that we'll be looking at on our away day on Saturday. And it is our ticket, if you like, through the letter of Ephesians, a beautiful letter. And we just had a little glimpse this morning of those opening verses of that letter and some background in one of my favourite passages from Acts, that goodbye scene on the beach as Paul says goodbye to some of his closest friends, the elders of the church at Ephesus. It's a very beautiful letter, the letter to the Ephesians. But as we are at the start of this, I just want to just kind of give you a bit of background into it. It's always good to know who the letter's from. And it has been assumed that it's from Paul, and most early manuscripts say it's from Paul, but not all of them, which gives us this tantalising bit of just unknown, isn't it? Because some scholars have suggested that the writing and the language in the letter to the Ephesians is really, really different to the other letters that he's written. But lots of scholars have said, and I tend to agree with them, that we all write differently for different situations, don't we? My texts and emails to individuals in the church are very different to the tone that I might use if I was writing the bit in front of Signpost, for example. And my emails to Alan would be very different to the ones that I might write to all of you. Now, I can see some of you are looking very concerned for our marriage if we've got down to writing emails to each other. But the kind of emails I send to Alan are, help, I can't get this film into a PowerPoint. Love you. And then he helps me out. So we write different things, don't we, and in different styles to people. And who was it written to? Well, again, there is some doubt about that. It was almost certainly the church at Ephesus, and that is spoken about in some early manuscripts, but again, not all. And what is much more likely from the tone and the subject matter is that this was a letter that Paul sent from prison. He was on his way there, as we know from that passage in Acts. He knew he was heading towards hardship and imprisonment to the church that he loved so much at Ephesus, but also to all the churches that had been planted in the area from that one church. So what we actually have here is a bit of a round robin letter that was designed to encourage people he knew well and loved, but also to encourage people he had never met. And this explains why, unlike his other letters, where there are always some references to individual people at the beginning or the end, there are no such personal notes in this letter. But that fits, doesn't it, with that idea of it being a round robin to many churches in that area where the message of Jesus was spreading like wildfire from this lovely church at Ephesus. And of course, what we pick up from the letter is that despite the fact that it's a mixed audience, this theme, the letter, contains one message that is relevant to everybody. Well, a little bit about Ephesus. There's a picture there of what remains of Ephesus. There, it was originally a Greek colony, but in Paul's time, it was the capital of the Roman province of Asia, what we would call Turkey now. And it was a busy commercial port. And it was also the headquarters of the cult of Diana, whose temple had been rebuilt and was actually one of the seven wonders of the world. And of course, what we read about in Acts is that Paul's visit and mission success had really ticked off the people making a living in Ephesus. Because if, in my mind, I kind of imagine a kind of first century Blackpool with all the shops selling their silver trinkets for you to take home, your souvenir of the Temple of Diana. And they were doing a roaring trade because people love to buy a souvenir, don't they? Wherever they go, we're all the same. And of course, when people started converting to the message of Jesus, Paul was making a big indent in their captive audience into the people that were lining their pockets, and that was not making him popular. What we know about Paul's visits to Ephesus is that he had one very glancing visit on a journey and then he went back. And as we found out from the reading that Sue read for us so beautifully this morning, is that he spent 3 years there, loving and growing that church. Well, it's good to have background, but background only gets us so far, doesn't it? Because we have to ask ourselves, what does this have to say to us today? Well, John Stott, that amazing scholar and churchman and follower of Jesus, says that the letter to the Ephesians has two key words running through the whole thing: grace and peace. Did you notice from those two verses that Sue read to us they were the two things that Paul prayed for the people that he was writing to? And they are words we sometimes end a letter with, aren't we? Sometimes I end an email or a letter or a communication with grace and peace at the bottom. And that's because they are things that we would all like in our lives, aren't they? And even if you're writing to someone who has no faith, as I often am in some of my wider roles in Croxley and beyond, grace and peace is something you can wish for, pray for anybody, things that we would all like in our lives. And these are the two things that Paul prays for his friends in Ephesus. And yet, what do they really mean? And how do we know if we've got them? Audrey really helpfully prayed for peace, didn't she, just before we came to look at this passage. And it's something we really are called to pray for the world, and it's something we spend time doing in this church, and I hope in our home groups and in our private devotions. It is part of our role as the Church of Christ in this world to pray for peace. But how do we know if we've got personal peace? How do we know if we've got lives full of grace? Well, I think Paul's relationship with the church in Ephesus, to me, speaks loudly of grace and peace. And we can see how these things are lived out in this speech to his friends, the elders of the church at Ephesus, as he makes his emotional goodbye on the beach. I love this passage because it shows to me that Paul, even though he was an amazing evangelist and a fantastic apostle, is still someone who needs his friends gathered around him at times of sadness. That's not a weakness, that's a strength. I just spent 3 days away, Wednesday to Friday, doing my yearly retreat with my oldest mates, with Emma and Sue. Three 50-year-old women in a camper van is not a pretty sight. But it was a great few days. And they are the people in my life who gather around me and we gather around each other and we pray for one another. We've been there at moments of total despair and loss for each other. And we've been there at times of amazing joy. And those kind of relationships take working at. They take time. And I think we have a good example here from Paul, is that these were the people he chose to be with as he set off to go back to what he knew was going to be a difficult road. And I'd encourage you, you know, maybe those friends for you are people that you've walked alongside in this fellowship for many, many years. Maybe they're someone you've only just met in the last few years. But make sure there are people around you that you can share those highs and lows with. This is part of God's gift to us. This is where we find grace and peace. Don't be an island. Make sure you share those things. Even Paul had to do that. Well, grace. There are all sorts of signs in Paul's speech which show us how much grace there was in his life and his relationships. And I just want to highlight a few of them. First one, in verse 18, he worked hard and with humility. Did you notice that? That bit about him providing for himself. We know from other bits of his writings that Paul was a tent maker, that wherever possible, that he wasn't a burden on the people that he was staying with and he'd come to mission to. And it's the same in Ephesus. And Paul's life, as we read about it in Acts and in his letters, could never be described as easy, could it? And yet he perseveres and he works hard to bring the good news of Jesus to complete strangers who in turn become those close friends. And his description of doing the Lord's work with tears doesn't really sound like a powerful and important evangelist, does it? You know that picture of him really grafting, having to support himself with his tent-making business on the side? That verse about, you know, I've cried tears because I'm so desperate for you to know the good news of Jesus could sound to us like someone who's a bit over-emotional and maybe not that successful. Well, I think what we want to learn from this is that this is the kind of life where grace grows. I want to say to us, beware. Beware the slick Christian leader who appears to be successful. Grace has a hard time growing in such a life. It's not impossible, but it's harder. Paul kept his feet on the ground. He worked for a living. He provided for himself and for others. And he shared the gospel with sweat and tears. Now, holiday adventure is still very much in our mind. And if you were part of that team, you will know it was hard work. And yet, when we worked together, shoulder to shoulder, making drinks, cleaning loos, teaching children, being gunged, serving hundreds of sausages and beef burgers. This is the place where grace grows. And there are many other areas of our church life where we work together. Light lunch starts again this week. And if you've been part of that team or you are still part of that team, you will know that it takes 20 to 30 people working together to make light lunch happen every Thursday, to make a place where people can walk through the door and find a welcome and a hot meal and friendship. This kind of work is not just for the benefit of those people outside the church, although that is primarily our mission imperative. But it is also for our benefit, because it is where we catch grace off each other, when we serve each other, when we work alongside each other, when we're prepared to do the menial tasks with each other, when we're prepared to laugh and cry with each other. That is where grace grows. Secondly, it's pretty obvious from that whole speech to his mates on the beach that Paul's first priority is that people know Jesus. You know, you can always tell a grace-filled person because they are always more concerned with how Jesus looks than how they look. A grace-filled person will always want whatever makes Jesus known to other people rather than their own preferences. Paul is a grace-filled person. He only wants what makes people see Jesus and their need for him. And we often worry far too much, don't we, about how we look and what we like. A couple of weeks ago when we were up in Scotland with our daughter and son-in-law, and they are in the process of changing churches, and they asked us if we would go to church with them on the Sunday morning because they wanted to try out the Baptist church in St Andrews. As you can imagine, that was not a difficult question for us. It made my heart glad that they would want to try the Baptist church, and we had a really blessed time there. The church there is too big to meet in the building in the High Street in St Andrews. It's meeting in the comprehensive school down the end of Helen and Lou's Road. And it was a wonderful welcome. It was a complete age range, which was what my daughter was missing in her kind of student church. And the minister there was preaching his penultimate last sermon. It's So you might think that's not a good time to go and try out our new church, but actually God was gracious, because that sermon that that minister preached was full of grace. It was a sermon about unity. And although first glances of this guy, it didn't make him look like he was a firebrand or a particularly magnetic personality, but when he spoke, oh, the love and grace in that sermon, where he thanked people, this, you know, big congregation full of people with all sorts of traditions, and they are traditional in Scotland, where he thanked them for the grace over the years, for people that had sung songs that were not their cup of tea, but had graciously done it for the sake of unity. And this sermon was beautiful because it asked his people, he said, after I've gone, keep thinking about the main things. Keep thinking about how Jesus looks, not what your preference is, because then the church will grow. That's grace, isn't it? You know, there's a question that resounds around the changing rooms of the shops of this nation. And if you're a lady, you've probably said it yourself. You've come out and asked your poor husband or somebody that's with you, trying to give you a good opinion. Does my bum look big in this? We've all asked it, haven't we? I've asked it. And the poor bloke or person outside has got, well, there's no right answer, is there? No right answer. And yet, I just wonder, you know, how much better would it be if we were to ask our nearest and dearest, those friends that gather around us that can speak truth into our lives, ask them, does Jesus look good in this? Does Jesus look good in the stuff that we're doing in our lives? Does Jesus look good in the way that I work? Does Jesus look good in the way that I parent? Does Jesus look good in the way that I relax and carve out time for rest and recreation? Whatever it is, does Jesus look good in this? Grace at work in our lives makes us ask that question and turns us into people like Paul, who are living to make Jesus visible and good to those who look at us. Thirdly, he was able to hand over to others. I wonder if you've ever had to hand over something precious to someone else to look after. Maybe it's letting your teenager drive your car. Perhaps it's handing over your baby to the childminder or a relative for the first time. Or maybe it's that project at work that you've nurtured and grown, and now it's time to let go. Maybe it's that ministry at church that you've looked after for many, many years, and you're having to hand over to new hands, or worse still, let it die. You know, trusting other people with the work and the gifts that God has given us is a sign of grace. Letting go and giving the glory to the next person coming along is a huge sign that grace is alive and well in someone's heart. And it's a personality trait of Jesus that we need to model. You see, he, of all people, could have been forgiven for not wanting to hand his message over. That unique message of salvation that only Jesus really has. That hope that only he can offer. You could have been very forgiven for thinking that Jesus might want to have exclusive rights for sharing that message. And yet what does he do? He hands it over to a group of failed disciples. And they hand it over to the next generation. And they hand it over to the next generation. And we have picked up the baton of that. And Jesus has handed us the responsibility of his message. He has amazingly entrusted his mission to us. You know, handing over precious ministries is a sign of grace. And Paul does this when he leaves his beloved church to others to lead, knowing full well that some of them will not do it as well as he has, knowing full well that some of them will lead them the wrong way, but knowing in that grace that Jesus is still Lord of that situation. I wonder what we might be hanging on to that the grace of Jesus would have us let go of today. Well, what about peace? Well, peace is something we'd all love more of, isn't it? We all crave a bit of peace every now and again. But it isn't that sort of peace we're talking about here. The sort of peace that God gives is not the sort that you find in a deserted beauty spot somewhere on holiday. It is the sort of peace that happens against the odds in the middle of chaos. And Paul has an abundance of this sort of peace. And although we can't see him face to face, we can see the results of it on the pages of Acts. You see, firstly, he is content with whatever he has. Verse 33. Paul was ministering in a rich place. The people he was speaking to and caring for would have been pretty well off. And yet he says he never coveted their fancy goods, their gold and their silver and their clothes. We live in a rich place, don't we, here in Croxley? And we may think that we are immune to coveting other people's silver and gold. But how many of us get the green eye at people's lives on Facebook, if that's what you do? Or maybe just hearing about their latest holiday or new car? Maybe we even feel envious of someone else's ministry. We are all tempted, aren't we, to make comparisons with our lives and the lives of others. And as Paul knew, comparison is the thief of joy and the destroyer of peace. And real peace comes when we stop looking at other people's lives and instead focus on what God has done in our own life. Paul says countless times that in spite of all the hardship of his ministry, he was content. He wouldn't have wanted anything different. That is the source of his peace. He has found complete identity and peace, not in an easy life and worldly goods or even in success, but in being obedient to what God had called him to do. His peace was found walking with Jesus on the road that only he could walk. And even when he knew that road would involve prison and ultimately death, that was still the only road he wanted to walk on. You know, and Peter had to learn that lesson, didn't he? When he stood on that beach, as Jesus restored him after he denied him three times, and he asks him those painful questions about, "Do you love me, Peter? Do you love me, Peter?" And then he explains to Peter the manner in which he's going to die and bring glory to God. And what is Peter's first response? What about him? He looks at John and says, "What about him?" And Jesus says, "Don't worry about him. Follow me." Peace only comes when we do what God has asked us to do and we stop looking at others. And how much more peace would we have if we could say the same? How much peace do we often forfeit, as the old hymn goes, because we always have one eye on what someone else is doing? Do we crave peace? Well, let's give up looking at other people's stuff, gifts, calling, health, and concentrate on the things that God has given us. And so finally, the characteristic that Paul has shown that he has both grace and peace is his unshakable, eternal perspective. You know, all through this goodbye to his friends, he has a hope for something bigger than his current experience. I want you to picture this goodbye. On the beach, the boat waiting, his friends sobbing, because as verse 38 says, he's told them he's never going to see them again. Paul knows that he's going to his death, that his trip to Jerusalem will ultimately end in his martyrdom. And yet his only concern is for them and that they might know the hope that he has in Jesus. This is a man with an eternal perspective. Paul knows that one day Jesus will make all things right, that one day all will be revealed, and the only thing that will matter is not how good you've been or how successful you've been or what you've got, but who you know. Your whole life can look like a complete disappointment in the world's eyes, but if you know Jesus, you are part of the great victory and one of the saints. I wonder how much reality that hope has for us today. Have we lost some of the grace and peace on offer because we have forgotten what is the only cosmically important thing? Where we stand in relation to Jesus. Paul is desperate for his friends to stay connected with that truth and to share it with others. And as a pastor, his heart's desire is for his people to live in the sure knowledge of the love Jesus has for them. And as pastors here, that is our desire too. For all of you here in this place, all we want for you is to live in the grace and the peace of that sure knowledge of Jesus' love and saving action for you. And if you've lost sight of it, it is our prayer that you catch the vision of it again. And if you have never known it, we don't want you to live another day without it. That's our prayer for you. Let's pray it for each other too. Amen.